城市匆忙，我总迷失方向，路上行人神色慌张，我内心冰凉。
Welcome to another episode of Lawyer Mind. Today's guest is award-winning author and biographer Jimmy Sani. He has written a number of books, including A Mind at Play, How Claude Shannon Invented the Information Age, and more recently, The Founders, The Story of PayPal and the Entrepreneurs Who Shaped Silicon Valley. Both of these books have been translated into Chinese. Their Chinese titles are 香农传从零到一开创信息时代另一本书呢叫做《疯狂创新者》。Jimmy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So we're here to talk about your latest book, The Founders. It tells the origin story of the PayPal Mafia. Some of our listeners might not be familiar with the term. So who are the PayPal Mafia and why are they interesting?
The PayPal Mafia is a term that's used to refer to the earliest employees of the company PayPal.And the reason that the term came about actually doesn't have much to do with PayPal. It has to do with the fact that these people today are considered kind of the leading lights of Silicon Valley. So they include people that your listeners will probably recognize, names that your listeners will recognize, Elon Musk, Peter Thiel, Reid Hoffman, Max Levchin, David Sachs. If you have ever watched a YouTube video, if you've ever been interested in LinkedIn,Palantir, Tesla, SpaceX, on and on. This group of people were either the creators of or the investors in almost every single company of consequence from Silicon Valley from about 2003 on. And so they are probably one of the most impressive alumni groups of any company ever in history. But they got the name the PayPal Mafia because they also all worked so closely together, specifically in the universe of technology. At around 2007, they started to gain some success. Facebook had done well. A bunch of things had gone right. And a magazine called them the PayPal Mafia. And it put a photo on the cover of a magazine of all of them dressed as mafiosos. And so that's where the name come from, and the name stuck. And, you know, what I would say is, like, it sounds a little tongue-in-cheek. It sounds kind of funny, right? But there is actually a real power in the network, in this particular network, where these people did go on to do things together even after they stopped working together at PayPal. But the importance of the book and of my work was they all met at this one company. And I thought it was just astonishing that so many talented entrepreneurs would end up at one company at one time. And that, to me, was like the biggest puzzle of this whole thing is, like, well, how did that happen? How is it that the founders of YouTube and the founders of SpaceX and the fact, you know, how did all these people, one place, like one company, how did you all end up there? And so that was what motivated the research.
By the way, I just want to put in a timeline for our listeners. So PayPal was founded in the late 90s, they went IPO, then got bought by eBay at around, 2002,
2003-ish? 2002.
So it's been 20 years. And sort of this group of talent, after the acquisition, sort of dispersed, and a lot of them went on to have their own successful careers, not just in technology. They were successful in all sorts of domains.
And it is actually one of the things that it's important, and I'm glad you mentioned the timeline, because they're not done. And so,
yeah, they're still going strong.
we're in 2024, and you basically can't open up the internet without reading about Elon Musk, right? Mm-hmm. Reid Hoffman is deeply involved in all things AI. Peter Thiel is still, you know, doing a million different things in politics and culture and all the rest. And that's just three people that I named. There are 250 or so alumni that were working in Palo Alto. And so many of them are still, you know, maybe late 40s, 50s, early 60s. They still are going to continue doing things in the world. While I was writing, the funny thing about writing the book was, in the course of writing the book, like, multiple employees that I was interviewing took companies public. You know, one of them was like deeply involved in, two of them were deeply involved in presidential campaigns. One of them became an ambassador while I was writing the book. You know, it was sort of like they continued to do things. So that's the other important thing, is understanding their origins is important because they're going to continue to be people of consequence for the next many, many, many years.
Your previous books were about Cato, the
ancient Roman,
politician, and about Claude Shannon. By the way, I'm really hoping that we get to, in this program, in this episode, get to talk about Claude Shannon, because I was a math major and Shannon is one of my intellectual heroes.
Oh, okay. So then, so you know his work then.
These two are very different from the PayPal story. So what got you interested in PayPal, and how is writing this book differ? How does it differ from writing your previous books?
Well, I think one really important difference is that those previous figures were both dead.
So you can't do interviews with them.
So I was dealing with subjects who were alive. You know, the ancient Roman senator Cato doesn't have 100 million Twitter followers, right? And so that made it a little easier to write about. More seriously. So here's the way it started. There's a connection between the two books. When I was doing the work on Claude Shannon, one of the ways that you come to understand Claude Shannon, and for your listeners, Claude Shannon was a famous electrical engineer and mathematician and he did his peak work was sort of in the 40s and 50s. He invented a field called information theory, which is basically, if ever going to boil it down, it's the intellectual framework for compression of information and for the transmission of information. And so the fact that Fang and I can have this discussion without the video taking like 3 days to load, that's because of the work that Claude Shannon did. If people want to even simplify it further, it's sort of like, how do ones and zeros get from one place to another? That's what Claude Shannon did. He worked at a place called Bell Labs, Bell Laboratories. And Bell Labs in the 20th century was an incredible collection of talent. They won, I think, 6 or 7 Nobel Prizes. They invented touch tone dialing, the transistor, the laser, you know, they did everything. And I started just thinking to myself and among friends, like, what are other collections of talent? The stories of startups are almost always told as like one person, Steve Jobs, Apple, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, you know, so on. But I was like really trying to think about like, what's a company where you just have an incredible collection of people? And PayPal came up. It was like one of the examples that always comes up. And I just went looking for a book about what happened? How did they all get there? What was created? What was the challenge? I couldn't find the book. And so that's what led me from Claude Shannon to PayPal. It was thinking about, well, Bell Labs, like they did all, these are all the crazy people and interesting projects and things, but what happened to PayPal? Like, why hasn't anybody written this book? Because this book seems to be far more interesting in some ways. And I also I was like, these people are all alive, so I could interview them. So you asked the question, what was the big difference in doing the projects? The biggest difference is that I had to do a lot more interviewing for this book. And so I interviewed several hundred people. I interviewed Elon, I interviewed Peter, I interviewed Max, all the people that we've talked about, because it was important for me to get, while I still could, they're still alive, I could get their recollections. I did not obviously have the chance to interview Claude Shannon, but I did interview his widow, Betty Shannon, and I interviewed his children, but obviously I couldn't interview him. So the biggest difference was dealing with subjects who are alive, you know, and also people, you know, they're sensitive about how they're going to be written about. I do, you know, there's certain things like that. But it was a different process writing about figures also who are so well known. Like that, you know, Claude Shannon is not, you know who he is, but many people do not, right? I think you have to live under a rock to not know today who Elon Musk is, right? And in technology, everybody knows who Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman are and others and David Sachs and so on. And so that was a big difference, was having subjects who were alive and then having subjects where everyone knew what they were doing at any given moment of the day, right? Those were big differences for me as an author.
I think by some account, you interviewed some 200-300 people over a course of 5 years.
Yeah, it was a lot of people.
So are these mostly sort of people directly involved with the company, i.e. employees and investors? I mean, who are they? What's like what are the profiles of the people you interviewed?
Yeah, so I kind of worked my way sort of both top down and bottom up. So I tried to interview or reach out to every person that worked in the Palo Alto, kind of the headquarters, between the years 1999 and 2002. And I kind of started with Peter Thiel and I kind of worked my way down. And I just tried to reach out to everybody I could. And anybody that said yes, I interviewed. And so it was everybody from, you know, the CEOs. There were multiple CEOs of the company over those years. I interviewed them all the way to like customer service agents, right, who were kind of at the other end of the spectrum. Because I thought I had an instinct that everybody who intersected with this company actually had something interesting to say. And it didn't matter if they were making the big decisions or if they were answering the phones. They kind of deserved to have they deserve the chance to share their story, right? And then it was up to me to figure out what made sense and what didn't. And so that was the ambition at the outset of the book. And then I just went and found person after person after person. But I would, to answer your question, they were at all levels. I interviewed interns and I interviewed board members. I interviewed competitors. I interviewed people, actually interviewed investors who thought about investing in PayPal and didn't and regretted it. I actually found them. I interviewed them. I also interviewed employees who left on good terms and employees who left on not great terms. So there were, and everybody in between. I really tried to cast a wide net and talk to anybody I could. And it took a long time. The book took 6 years to write, but it was all of that work is part of what led to what I think are some facts and some stories that have never emerged before about this group of people and about this time in their lives.
You've interviewed interns. How do you know who interned at PayPal during that time? That's a long time ago.
You can use LinkedIn. So what you do is you go on LinkedIn and you can find who kind of worked at the company for a certain chunk of time. And then you can use that. I also had a bunch of people share documents with me. And one of the documents that somebody shared was actually this really interesting document that speaks to the company. They shared a list of people who got equity. And there were a bunch of people who got sort of small amounts of equity. And I was like, wait, what is it? Why are these amounts of equity so small compared to the other employees? And it turned out that one of the things that PayPal did is it would give its interns equity.
Wow.
And not everybody, but a certain number of them. And so it was a way to encourage them to take the role seriously. And so I found those people, and then I would go and I would use LinkedIn and I would send emails and figure out who knew who, and I would try to find out what they did. And then sometimes what would happen is, like, a good example is, like, I would interview somebody and they would say, oh, you should really talk to my friend Susie or John or somebody. You know, it's like, you should really talk to so-and-so. I'll do an introduction. So they would do an introduction. And then I just did that year, day after day, year after year, until I had interviewed hundreds of people.
It's really cool that you're using LinkedIn to do research for this book, and LinkedIn is founded by another one of the PayPal mafias.
Oh, trust me, the irony was not lost on me. That is very true.
The PayPal story it's been 20 years, but it's still relatively more recent compared to, say, Shannon, and certainly compared to Cato. I think one advantage of putting a distance between the events that actually took place to writing it is that you have the benefit of hindsight and knowing what is important. But PayPal has only been 20 years, as you are saying. The story is still going on. The people are still going strong. So how do you decide to make the call of, like, what's important, what are consequential when the events are still being played out?
I should say that for the book itself, I really focus on the years 1998 to late 2002. And those events are done, right? And in fact, there are some people from the original group of employees, a couple, who are still at PayPal, but most of the people have long since left. And so I didn't have to worry too much that the story is still unfolding. Now, the story of the lives of the lives of the people who are a part of this group, that's still unfolding. But the PayPal story from the years 1999 to 2003, 2002, that's largely done. It's not quite hard cement, but it's not wet cement. I mean, this is pretty done. Like, what happened happened, right? And then I had the benefit of thousands and thousands of pages of documents that someone shared with me from that period. So part of the reason that the book has, like, original emails in it is because I had access to original emails, and I would go through this massive treasure trove of papers. So if interviews constituted, let's say, I don't know, 40%, 30% of the research, the other sort of 60% came from these volumes of emails where I could basically see day by day, almost minute by minute sometimes, what was happening with the company. And so that is why I was able to tell this as a historical story and not as a story where I like didn't quite know how things were going to work out, right? I mean, I knew exactly what had happened at different moments down to the level of Excel spreadsheet specificity. Like I could do that because I had access to the paper.
So you wrote the book to understand how is it possible that such a group of very talented people come together and what happens when they do. So I'm going to get to the punchline. What's the secret sauce at PayPal?
Yeah. No, it's a good question. It's also a tough question because there's not one silver bullet answer, right? So I'll just sort of throw out what I learned in the course of doing the project. And you know, you give different people, if you were going to talk to them, would give different weight to these components, right? One thing that's common to the employees that I interviewed is that they were all ferociously intelligent. Kind of table stakes at PayPal, the bare minimum of PayPal. Was just being very, very smart, you know, and like they were just very, very, very smart people. I had this interview with an engineer. He said he described it as being spoiled. He said, I was so spoiled at PayPal because my assumption in future jobs was that everyone was just really good at their jobs because everyone at PayPal was just really good at their jobs. He said, I quickly learned that that wasn't the case. But he's like, at PayPal, everybody was just really talented. So that the talents, the intellect, the willingness to work hard was very, very high. That was one key ingredient. Second key ingredient is timing. PayPal, a couple of examples. PayPal starts in 1999. The dot-com bubble bursts in the year 2000. And just before the dot-com bubble bursts, PayPal closes $100 million in financing. So it has the runway to ride out the worst of the dot-com bubble bursting, and then it can find its way to success, and then it can IPO and all the rest. So that's sort of like key ingredient number two is timing. Key ingredient number three is that the company achieved product market fit on eBay, and eBay had not figured out how it was going to do payments. So because your listeners are not going to be totally familiar with the story, let me give a bit of background on this. PayPal becomes successful first on what is then like a large, but not, you know, a large auction website called eBay. eBay had done many things right, and it had been one of the internet success stories. One of the things that it had done right in some ways is that it let its buyers and sellers, its auctioneers and its customers, figure out how to do payments once the auctions were done. eBay didn't want to deal with payments. They didn't want to deal with the regulations. They didn't want to deal with the muss and fuss. But it left a big opening for a company like PayPal, which was making digital payments easier and simpler and cheaper. It left an opening for PayPal to come in and say, well, we're gonna be the eBay payment system of choice, right? The line that many employees will use when they describe it is that it's almost like we took over the cash registers at someone else's store, that we were the cash registers for this store. So if you walked into Target, and Walmart was running the cash registers. That's what it was like.
eBay actually tried to build their own payment system, but they just couldn't compete with PayPal. Imagine that. It's your own platform, and you couldn't compete with a third-party payment system.
And it's a huge part of the story, the fact that eBay bought another company called BillPoint, tried to make them succeed on its own platform, then tried to basically boot PayPal off and make PayPal's like not work as well, and still couldn't succeed. Then PayPal went public and eBay eventually ended up acquiring them. And so there's this kind of crazy thing about they had to acquire this company that basically became a parasite on their platform servicing their customers. And we can go into why that happened and how it happened. But that's kind of like key ingredient three is finding product market fit. And I would say key ingredient four, and I'll just limit it to four because I could go on. You know, maybe there's like 20. But the fourth big one for me when I look back at the story is a culture that prioritized aggressive problem solving. And I think this was like kind of through and through the thing that I saw again and again is that the company would face some issue or problem or circumstance, and everybody would just like attack that problem until it was fixed. And then they would move on to the next problem. I had a board member describe it. He said it was almost like we built like an immune system. Like he's like, you'd have this like thing that came in and all these cells would sort of congregate around this problem. And then it would move on to the next problem. That culture of basically relentless problem solving again and again and again and again and again for years is what made the company ultimately very successful. But I don't think that's how all companies are run. And I do think it's like specific enough to point out as like one key contributor to the success is a culture that was around this kind of rapid fire problem solving.
You mentioned that there are other clusters of talents that you were interested in, the Bell Labs, for example. I can think of other similar ones. Xerox PARC for a time.
It's a great example.
First batch of YC companies, many of them have gone on to do great things. What would you say are the similarities across all these clusters, and how does PayPal differ from them?
That's a great question. There are a number of similarities. I would say specifically among the engineers, you know, there's a very similar cast of mind, very similar, like the passion for technology, a kind of relentlessness around like wanting to build something. You know, all the sort of classic entrepreneurial things end up being true, right? Across like Fairchild, Semiconductor, Xerox PARC, or whatever. With PayPal, I think the key difference, one, is it's 1999, right? So it's in the sort of like tail end of the dot-com bubble, you know, becoming a thing and the internet becoming a mainstay in people's lives. They just had the benefit of that kind of timing, right? The other is that technology has moved from hardware to software to the web. And so that's just a very different ecosystem than if you're trying to build, let's say, like Apple, which was primarily a hardware company in its inception, or even Fairchild. So you have it's that same level of hustle, the same level of sort of grit and stick-to-itiveness just applied to the internet. You know, so it's very different. You're fighting very different battles. There's a speed of feedback from your customers to you that wasn't necessarily true when you had long cycles of product development for hardware companies, right? The other thing I'll say is PayPal, I would say, faced near bankruptcy many, many, many more times than those other clusters. And I'd say like near failure and then also near bankruptcy. So far as I know, Bell Labs never really had a moment where they thought Bell Labs could go under. Like there was never actually, nobody seriously thought like, oh, in fact, the joke at Bell Labs, there was this line that was in my Claude Shannon book. This person was working on a problem and he said, well, this could take 20 years to solve. And I guess his boss said, don't worry, we'll be here in 20 years. You just keep going. Nobody, I mean, you barely had 20 days at PayPal to get something done. And so the speed of implementation and the speed of iteration at PayPal was far, far faster, driven purely by the fact that the money was running out, the company was struggling. And just to give your listeners some context for what I mean when I say that, I mentioned that PayPal closed a very large round of financing in the spring of 2000, around $100 million. What I didn't share is that they were burning between $10 and $15 million a month on fraud. And so they didn't have much runway. And at one point in the summer of 2000...
Wow, so that was only like half a year of runway for them.
Yeah, I was about to say, in the summer of 2000, the company has 5 to 6 months of runway left, and then they would have to shut down operations. And it was that dire. And there's no point in the history that I've seen of either Xerox PARC or Bell Labs where they face that kind of threat to their existence and future. And what I would say is like, what is the effect of that? The effect of that is that it raises the pressure on everyone at PayPal to be successful and to make the company successful and to fix its biggest challenges. Because if they can't do it, they will be done. And there's a number of people who shared with me. They said, you know, that is actually one of the big things that led us to success is that we just felt like we would wake up the next morning and the company would be finished. And they are operating, especially in the year 2000, at a time when they wake up and the news contains another announcement of a company going under, another announcement of a company having to like liquidate or fire everybody or sell itself off for parts. So this was a very real pressure that was around them. One of the employees I interviewed spoke to me and he said, you know, I still remember walking around the streets of Palo Alto and seeing windows get boarded up because a startup was going out of business. And he said, and there was like a real quality of like a fear. Like we would wake up every day afraid that today was the day that we were going to go under. And that fear led to pressure, and pressure led them to success.
I think some of our listeners are probably too young to remember this. NASDAQ peaked in around 1999, 2000-ish. and took a plunge and didn't recover for a number of years. So it was a really dire time.
And it's actually one of the parts of the story I looked at most closely. The NASDAQ loses, I think, 86% of its value from the start of 2000 to the end of 2000. There's a kind of dark irony, which is that in early 2000, in January, all of these dot-coms were buying Super Bowl ads, very expensive ads to advertise during the American Super Bowl, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with. These are multi-million dollar ads. And there's one famous company, Pets.com, infamous, I guess, is the word, not famous. Pets.com buys this very expensive Super Bowl ad. And I guess 8 or 9 months after the ad airs, they are bankrupt. And this happens again and again. The story of the year 2000, one of the people who I interviewed described to me, said the Silicon Valley was the killing fields. He said, you know, you just wake up and every day something, some new piece of bad news. And that context is very, very important because it is in that period that PayPal really comes into its own. It really becomes a company during that time when all of these companies are going under.
So PayPal went public and it was a unicorn even at that time. But because of the performance in the stock market, they decided to go private again and merge with eBay. And many of the top talents left PayPal pretty soon after.
Almost right away, yeah.
Peter Thiel very famously sent out an email and left the company very soon after, yeah. PayPal is enough of a success, both in terms of its financial outcome and also in terms of attracting an exceptional pool of talent, that the people who are involved had a taste of what success looks like. But it's not such a big success that people wanted to stay on. Unlike, say, some of the more recent examples like Airbnb. So they dispersed. And it was actually this dispersing made it possible for them to go on to have a variety of different careers. Especially Peter Thiel, reading the book, I got the sense that he was actually quite reluctant to be involved with PayPal. Like, he didn't want to be the CEO, and he left quickly after the company was acquired.
That is spot on. You gave the best description that I've heard outside of my own writing about it. That is actually 100% accurate. What happens for your listeners, just so they know, February 2002 is a big event in the lives of all of the people involved in PayPal. The company goes public. It is one of the first dot-com IPOs after the bubble has burst. It has a surprisingly good day. The stock goes up that day, and it's actually like a sign that things, the market might be healing. Another important context point for listeners is that September 11th was just 6 months before this, right? So not only had the dot-com bubble burst, but the terrorist attack had also left, you know, the financial district in ruins, and there was a big downturn in the market right after. So PayPal goes public in February of 2002. For years, PayPal has been battling eBay for the reason that you mentioned, which is eBay is like, these people are like our cash register, but we don't own them. They're their own entity. We have our payment. Yeah. And then nobody cares about our entity called BillPoint, and they're not using it. And we, you know, so there's this fight that goes on for many, many years. And it's like a really interesting battle between the two companies. It's sort of like, what happens if you built a company within another company? Eventually, eBay realizes this nuisance now is like a serious nuisance. They've gone public. We know what they're worth. Let's just acquire them and be done with it. And there's a series of negotiations. But by July of 2002, eBay has reached an agreement with PayPal to acquire PayPal. And over the summer, those agreements are ratified and everything gets done. And almost immediately, many of the senior team of PayPal leave right away. There are obvious reasons for this. You know, eBay has a CEO. eBay has a CTO. eBay has an infrastructure of its own. It doesn't need a new executive team. There's also some reasons around eBay was a big company by this point. It had been public for a number of years. It had more of a professional managerial kind of operating environment. PayPal was very much a startup. And there were groups of people within this company, meaning PayPal, that were more comfortable in the informal environment of a startup than they were in the more formal environment of eBay. And so you have people like David Sachs and Peter Thiel and Reid Hoffman and later Max Levchin, who like leave within 2002 and 2003. They're all gone. Not everybody leaves, but many of the senior most people do leave. And you're right that the dispersal is actually powerful fuel for what happens next, which is they all start to work together and build things and invest in things. And they're all kind of helping each other take these new ventures, get these new ventures going. And some of those new ventures are Yelp and YouTube and Yammer and Palantir and Founders Fund and SpaceX and LinkedIn and Tesla and all these things that they're doing. It's partly because they weren't shackled down at another company. They weren't an independent PayPal. The way David Sacks described it is he said, we were a little bit like the Jews. I think he said, he's like, you know, we came in, they burned down our temple and we were all banished to the, you know, scattered to the winds. And so there's a quality there of many people weren't going to stay there. So they had to go figure out what they were going to do with their time. So your theory is exactly right.
You said something really interesting about Bell Lab. One of the senior managers said, we're still going to be here 20 years. I think the irony is that they're actually not around anymore. Or if they are, they're not talked as often anymore. The same goes for Xerox PARCs. I'm wondering why there are no more Xerox PARCs or Bell Labs anymore in corporate America. Maybe there are. I'm just not aware of it.
It's a question that, I mean, there have been so many papers and discussions and panels and books and everything else that have tried to get at this exact question, like what happened to the age of like the great corporate research park? And to be honest, I didn't write a book about Xerox PARC or about Bell Labs. So my answers are going to be based on what work I did to understand those places. I mean, I think a big part of it is like the incentives have changed, right? Particularly Bell Labs was basically like underwritten by the government for a number of years, right? Bell owned the Bell, for listeners, Bell Laboratories was part of the Bell telephone system, which was started by Alexander Graham Bell. And essentially what they have is a federally guaranteed monopoly to keep the phone system running. And they can take some amount of money and put it into this tiny little thing called Bell Laboratories where they do all the crazy research. Now, there have been attempts made, you know, places like Google to do like Google X, their moonshot factory. And there have been attempts made at other places to build little like outposts like this. But to be honest, I think that the structure and incentives of technology in the United States have changed, where it's going to be really hard for a big company to attract the kind of talent that's going to create something like path-breaking and then have it like not make them a lot of money. So here's what I mean. Like if you are Elon Musk, if you're a young Elon Musk, let's say you're somebody who's coming up in the world right now, what you're going to be drawn to is a Silicon Valley in which you go, you raise capital, you build something, you take it public maybe, or you build it into something really big, and you get the benefit of the economic benefit accrues to you. You're not going to be as excited, I think, about going to like a research park or university where you don't have a meaningful ownership stake in the thing that you create. I think those days are just, they're a little bit distant now. I'm sure they exist in pockets somewhere. And I know there are research institutes here and there that are doing things. But the fact is that like the template for entrepreneurial success in the United States is no longer about corporate research parks. It's about startups in Austin and Miami and in Silicon Valley. And so we're just in a different time. It's like a different era.
And to be honest, I'm not sure that's the best way to organize research either.
Exactly.
Perhaps there are more efficient ways of doing that.
I think, and by the way, I think there are, like there's some argument to be made that like universities have a role to play. And Bell Labs was obviously very tied in with universities. They were always pulling university researchers into their ranks. I'm sure that that needs to happen more often, but that's become harder for a variety of reasons. I'm far from the expert on this topic, by the way. But what I do know is that like, call it the Elon effect. There was a time when young scientists looked up to the scientists who were at Bell Labs. But if you're a young scientific or engineering mind today, it's hard not to look at what's happening in the private sector and think, wow, that would be really cool to work on. And it just feels like the energy is there, the money is there, the ambition is there. If you want to make a real dent, it's going to happen in that kind of startup culture and not necessarily at a research institute, no matter how good it is.
There have been surveys that showing that young people, they don't exactly aspire to become top engineers or even top entrepreneurs. The most desired career path is to be a social influencer. I'm wondering what's going to happen in 20 years. Maybe we'll see clusters of top social influencers.
Good for the world. That's terrible. I mean, I'm joking. I don't think that's very good for the world. I mean, that's like, we should think about this question seriously. Like, there's all the obvious reasons why I think that's not great. But what I would say is that I think some of the surveys may be underestimating the narratives around people like Elon miss the fact that he has a physics degree and he's quite well versed in the technical components of the businesses he runs. And that's like a missing link in this, in the whole discussion around him. It's all become celebrity stuff and tweeting and this and that. But you sort of miss that multiple people who work at very high levels in fields like rocket engineering, automotive engineering, will comment about how shockingly well-informed he is. And it shouldn't shock anybody. He runs these companies, but he's actually like an engineer's engineer. You know, he is an engineer. And I think that's like what's missing, is that like somehow we decided that because he's been successful in business, he doesn't have engineering chops. I don't know where that fiction got started, right? And so I think that needs to be corrected, because the truth is the reason he's been successful in business is in part because he had training in, he was scientifically literate getting out of school. That was important. It wasn't just that he knew how to write code. It was that he also understood other things. He was writing papers about rocket engineering and about clean technology when he was in college. And he had mentors who were PhDs in science. And so I just think that needs to, like, a little bit of course correction. Like, we should, at least I hope it does, because if everybody is just like a TikTok influencer 20 years from now, like, wow, that will be a very, very sad world.
And Elon, I think he sold computer games when he was just a teenager. So he's a competent programmer.
And at a minimum, he at least wanted to have that skill set and to develop things and to sell things. He had a computer company when he was a freshman in college. I found the ad for it, and it was really an interesting ad. And like, he had been mixing technology with entrepreneurship since he was very, very young. And I think that's like sometimes missing in the discussion about him, because I think the discussion now just gets sort of obscured by wealth and everything else. Right. But like, this is a person who is basically building businesses from, you know, his earliest years on, and somebody who very seriously studied science and technology. I don't understand why like that can't be a part of this.
He was going to do he got accepted into the Stanford material science PhD program. So he was going to be a scientist if he wanted to.
Yeah. And he didn't even drop out. He just deferred his material science PhD for a little while. And then his tech company started to take off. And that was his first company. It was called Zip2. I think that this is like an interesting thing, though, because if we don't fix this, then people will think, oh, building a business is just about influence. But building a business is actually like, there's a, especially in technology, like there's a part of it that is just technical. I think that people need to appreciate that a little bit more, that you don't sort of get to SpaceX just by being able to like tweet well.
I think the myth, or perhaps the idea of, you don't necessarily need to have the technical chops to successfully run a tech company, came from Steve Jobs. I mean, not Steve Jobs, but people's interpretation of how he succeeded. At least when I talk to some young entrepreneurs, I got the sense that, well, look at Steve Jobs. He's a marketing genius, and he was able to run a successful company like Apple and do product innovation. So yeah, I think that's the origin of that idea.
I'm in the middle of one of my next projects, which is about Steve Jobs. And so I would push back on some of that. Not because Steve was writing the code for various, you know, things that Apple and his other companies did, but because he had far more technical chops than people think. He worked at Atari, right? So he had actually did have some experience like designing technologies. And then I would say the other piece of it is that marketing is different from design, and marketing is different from user experience. And two of the areas where multiple people that I've interviewed who have commented on his exceptional skill and ability is user experience and user interface and design. And so those are not engineering skills, but they aren't that dissimilar, right? In the sense that like, there's actually like a body of literature, it's highly technical. And it requires something more than just the ability to come up with clever taglines or do advertising really well. I'm not saying, by the way, that those are not valuable skills. I do think that marketing was a big part of what made Apple successful. But the deeper day-to-day work is in the interviews. For example, when I'm interviewing, I interviewed an engineer at this software company Next. And I'm sorry, I was a hardware company and software company Next. And they said, you know, Steve would come in and he would look at a piece of software and right away he would see the thing that was going to frustrate users when they tried to use it. And he would point it out and he would just like yell at us until we fixed it and figured it out. There's that. That is the actual, you know, work of creating these companies. It is getting to that level of specificity and making things seamless for users. And I don't think that that is just good marketing. And obviously, like you were presenting someone else's argument, you know. But I think it's important for people to remember, like, there's a lot that goes into these companies that you don't see. And it's actually one of the things that's fun about writing these books is I get to like even ask the question, why was it called PayPal? Why is the color blue instead of red? Why was it successful where everyone else failed? And so that's like, there's a lot there. A lot of thinking goes into that. That is more than just like luck or, you know, random assortment of things that happen to come together.
Well, I think people who have that opinion, like you just need to be a marketing genius, will really just give themselves an easy way out because it's easy to tell and it's harder to become someone who's technically competent. But if you're just coming down to, oh, I have better taste, you know, who's to argue with you? You have better taste in marketing. And
taste matters, but I don't think it matters as much. Like it matters, but it's not the thing. There's you still have to have a product to market. The creation of those products is still in the hands of many people who have technical skills.
Okay, another observation, and I'm sure it's been pointed out multiple times, is that the key figures in the PayPal story, Levchin, Musk, and Peter Thiel, we're all foreign-born.
Mm.
I think in college, we have this term called 1.5 generation. So they're not exactly first-generation immigrants. So they didn't go to the States as adults. But they're not exactly second-generation either because they were foreign-born. And especially in the case of Levchin and Musk, they went to the States as teenagers. I just thought that's such an interesting observation. And it could be just a coincidence. What do you think of it?
I don't think it's a coincidence at all. I mean, in the sense that it's actually it goes even further. So UPan, who's one of the founders of this is just context for your listeners. Again, PayPal, as you know it, or as your listeners know it, is the merger of two companies. One company is called Confinity. It was created by Peter Thiel and Max Levchin. The other company is called X.com, was created by Elon. They merge in the year 2000. That forms the PayPal that we know and use today. Of the group that like Elon, Peter, Max Levchin, David Sachs is also an immigrant. He was born in South Africa, I believe. UPan, who was one of the co-founders of Confinity, also an immigrant. On and on and on. And by the way, if I went through the roster, you'd be astonished at the percentage of immigrants that are a part of the group. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think there's other smarter people than me who have written the book and articles and given talks about why it is that Silicon Valley is a place that attracts immigrants. What I can tell you is from the PayPal story or from the PayPal perspective, there are an awful lot of people who are foreign born. And it could also just be the case that like part of being an immigrant is embracing that there are going to be certain things that will seem odd to other people that will not seem odd to you. Like a good example would be accented English, right? Max Levchin grew up with accented English. So the idea of somebody having a thick accent isn't going to be perplexing to him, right? But it might be perplexing to somebody else. And so I think there's an affinity there for sure. The other piece of it is that there is a kind of, I was, by the way, cards on the table. My parents were immigrants. I'm in that 1.5. Like, you know, I was not born in the United States, but I grew up mostly in the United States. And I do think it influenced the writing of this book, by the way, because I could understand these people. I got what it meant to feel like you're playing without a safety net, that you are often told the story of your parents sacrificing so much so that you can be in the United States, all these things. These are very familiar themes to me, right? They come up in my life, too. And I could kind of like see their, I was like, oh, I know this movie. I mean, I lived this movie. This is my movie. You know, and so I think that there is a certain amount of grit and perseverance and a kind of sense that you have to succeed, that you just, you, that success, that there's no uncle who's going to come bail you out, that there's no family that you can fall back on because all the family is back thousands of miles away somewhere. I heard those messages as a kid. I'm sure the people who founded PayPal heard those messages when they were young. And I think it's a part of the Silicon Valley story. I think it's, there is a high degree of overlap. And again, smarter people than me have done the research on it, but there are some astonishing number of companies that come out of Silicon Valley that are either founded by immigrants or, as you said, like the sort of 1.5 generation, right? And I don't think that's any accident at all.
So for the people who were foreign born, but moved to the States at a fairly young age, you don't have the obstacles that typical immigrants face, such as language problems or unfamiliar with the culture. So in other words, you know how the game is played, you know the rules, but sure. Yet you still have the benefits of being an outsider and being able to look at things from an outside perspective and notice, oh, where things are could be better. In doing a startup, when you have to pitch, you have to know how to craft your message, especially if you're building a direct-to-consumer product or service, you need to know how to do marketing right. And these can be very subtle. It's so much easier if you have one foot already in the culture.
I think that's right. I mean, and I think it'd be hard. You'd be hard pressed to, if you didn't, you like wouldn't, like you said, you wouldn't have a fluency that's required to actually get some of these things. And by the way, these teams are big. Many of them are also not immigrants, right? There are plenty of people on the PayPal team who are Americans for many generations. The thing I would add that struck me as I was reading the story and trying to make sense of it and then explaining it to readers and learning about these people is that startups are also an exercise in managing scarcity, right? So you are dealing with scarcity of time and scarcity of resources in general, like money, everything, money, time, all of it, scarcity of people. And, you know, in a very real way, like being an immigrant to any place is having to deal with scarcity, right? You have to be resourceful. And again, I don't want to make too much of this because I'm sure that there's like good arguments against, but there's a scrappiness about the immigrant experience that translates very well to the scrappiness of the startup experience. You learn to do more with less. You simply have to. There isn't any other way. And you learn to figure out what in the system makes sense for you, what doesn't. And I'm sure that influences the droves of people who come to Silicon Valley. The other thing is that many of the countries that people are immigrating from prize technical skills and abilities, right? And so that's true in the case of Max Levchin. It's true in the case of Sanjay Bhargava, who was another big, important person at PayPal, came up with a key innovation. Santosh Janardhan, I could go on down the list, but like they come from countries where math and science aptitude is highly prized. And then that translates very well to doing well in Silicon Valley. Again, I'm like not the expert here, but there's a clear correlation here that it seems to make sense.
Two members out of the whole PayPal mafia tends to draw all the attention. That's Musk and Peter Thiel. Of the two, Musk is the more familiar one to our listeners. So I want to spend a little time on Peter Thiel. Especially he went down to, like Musk had wild success after PayPal, but he was still doing startups. I mean, crazy startups, but still startups in the technical realm. And I guess that's a more familiar story. But Peter Thiel was just doing things in, like he was running a hedge fund. He started Funders Fund. He invested in Facebook. Mm-hmm. He started this Thiel Fellowship. So he was doing a variety of different things. So tell us more about him and what are the traits that you think contributed to his success?
No, it's a great question. And, you know, he's a co-founder of PayPal. He is the person who identifies and finds, like Max Levchin has an idea for a company. He meets with Peter and Peter says, you should do, you know, he has an idea for two companies, actually. And Peter says, you should do, you know, A, not B. Don't do that one. Do this one. And I'll invest if you do this one. So he gives him his first money. What happens very quickly is that Max realizes Peter's really smart. Max says, I have an aptitude for computer science and for the engineering side of things, but I have no aptitude for business, at least not, you know, in the formal sense. But Peter's really smart. I should bring him on to be CEO. So Max asks him to be CEO. Peter hems and haws and finally agrees to do it. And that is how Peter becomes CEO of PayPal and Max becomes CTO of PayPal. They're a really amazing partnership. They balance each other out very well. They bring different skills to the table. And from there, you know, you have this thing happen where they're both magnets for crazy talent. And if you had to ask me to identify like one thing, if you said you can name the one skill that Peter Thiel has that puts him head and shoulders above everybody else, it is talent identification and talent recruitment. Peter has an unbelievable ability to find super talented people. And then he does this thing that I saw throughout my interviews. And I'm going to describe it, and I won't really do justice to it, but I'll describe it the best I can. I had multiple people tell me some version of the following. They said, when you talk to Peter, what Peter does is he sketches out the biggest vision that you could have for your life. Like, he believes in you more than you believe in yourself, and he'll kind of tell you what could happen. Like, in a weird way, without really laying it on too thick, he'll tell you what the biggest version or vision of your life could be. And somehow he believes it. And then you start to believe it. And then you join him in the enterprise and you make it happen. Max Levchin said this to me in particular. He said, you know, that was a big thing for me, is that like Peter actually believed and could tell me like how things were going to go, and then tell me like where I was going wrong. Like, he would say, like, you can't focus on these small problems. You have to focus on these big problems. That is a great gift. I mean, that's like to be able to identify talent. You know, this is somebody who meets Mark Zuckerberg when Mark Zuckerberg can't communicate with anybody and recognizes, wow, this person's really talented. He gives him his first $500,000 outside investment. That's the first money, outside money, into Facebook. And that becomes a sum, let's just say, worth many, 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 many multiples of $500,000. And so he does this. The second thing I would say, the second skill that's a cousin skill to this, is I interviewed a number of people who had come off some recent failure. So maybe they'd been fired, maybe a business that they were in hadn't worked out, something had gone wrong in their lives. And Peter was there to give them the chance to try again. And I saw this second chance thing happen over and over again. This one person, it was actually after the PayPal years, he had a failure and he was looking to do something, and he wanted to do something new, and he didn't think anybody would invest in him. And he was meeting with Peter, and Peter said, oh, I'll invest in you. Here you go. And he gave him, you know, and there was a woman who was a lawyer who had just been fired from a startup, met somebody at PayPal, sat down with Peter. She explained she'd just been fired. She didn't think she was going to get the job. Peter said, no, you'll be great at this. Come do it. He would give people second chances often enough that it became like a pattern that I noticed when I was doing my writing. And then the last thing I would say about on this Peter subject is he would promote younger people and give power to people that seasoned operators didn't expect would succeed. So he would pick somebody for a job that, like, maybe the board wasn't entirely in agreement that this person was a good fit for the job, but then they would prove to be just amazing. And he does this again and again. He does this with Reid Hoffman, who he names COO, above the board, like against the board's wishes. He does this with David Sachs. The team doesn't want to hire David Sachs. Peter says, no, we need somebody like David Sachs in the room. He's going to do it. There's a young, at the time, a young man named Roelof Botha, who today is the head of Sequoia Capital. Roelof is 26. He's just out of his Stanford MBA program, I think. And Peter needs a CFO. He sees that Roelof is brilliant. Roelof understands the business. The board says you cannot name a 26-year-old CFO because, like, that's just not done. Peter says, no, this is our guy. He knows the business. He ends up successfully leading Roelof, successfully leading the company through its IPO. So again and again, he picks people for roles that ordinary people might not, like, make that same decision. But Peter just invests these people with a lot of faith. And those are three things that I think sometimes people miss about him: the talent identification, the willingness to take second chances on people, and this ability to find somebody who maybe doesn't seem like they're cut for a particular role, but he puts them there and they thrive.
So of the three things you said, I think the second and the third sort of rest on top of the ability to identify talents. I have such confidence in your assessment that you would give people second chances, you would put people in positions that they don't seem prepared for. So obviously, this is an amazing ability to have. How do we become more like him? How do we emulate that trait? And also, the same goes for Elon and also for Shannon. Shannon is obviously such a genius. Reading the book, you just feel like, wow, they seem to have this magic power. But how can I be more like them? Where do they acquire these traits? Are they just born with it? Or
it's a great question. I'll give sort of one thought for each person because they're very different, right? So Shannon, Musk, and Thiel, very, very different. So for Thiel, that's I would say, of the three, it's actually the hardest one to say, how do you become like more, you know, more like this person? Because I think Peter's actually very singular, like and it's very hard to emulate him. But if you were going to do anything, I think one of the things that you would do is that you would embrace ideas that are at the fringes, and you would have an openness to crazy ideas, or what people would call crazy ideas in quotation, you know, marks. Like, there are things that Peter has been involved in over the course of his career that many people wrote off until they became the truth. Here's a great example. Years and years and years ago, he starts a program called, as you mentioned, the Thiel Fellowship, which pays people essentially to drop out of school to pursue a startup, right? And you can kind of apply and you'll get, I don't know what the amount of money is. And then there's some, you know, it's a process. It was partly a way of showing that perhaps the modern educational infrastructure was not doing a good job of channeling the talents of young people. In 2024, the American people are now like less optimistic that college is going to actually satisfy and prepare people for satisfy professional ambitions and prepare people for professional life than they've ever been. Peter had a lot of foresight in knowing that this is a trend that's going to happen, but I'm just going to put my money where my mouth is. At the time, he was criticized by everyone. Everyone. And it was like unbelievable. Like he's coming, you know, this is terrible. Why would you encourage children to drop out of college? That's a terrible thing to do, you know. And now he looks like a prophet. You know, people are saying, like, what is the value of college in an era of X, Y, Z, right? And so I think the willingness to embrace ideas that can seem controversial or that can seem like they are at the fringes is a thing that you can cultivate. If you want it to be more like him, when someone says something to you, let's say they say something and they're like, well, that's a crazy idea. If you even take even a half second to spend some time really thinking, well, why did that person think this was crazy? Like, what is crazy about this, right? What if that was like, that kind of embrace is something that we can all cultivate. There was a time when the people who said, you know, the earth is not the center of the universe, that the sun is actually the center of our solar system. Those people were thought to be crazy. Galileo was thought to be crazy. He was thought to be a crazy person, right? And so I think the embrace of crazy ideas is probably one way to become more like Peter. With Elon, this answer is much simpler, which is if you have a vision for your life, if you have a vision for the thing you want to do in the world, just decide what it is and stick with it for 5 decades. You know, stick with it for 3 or 4 decades. Like, actually, his talent is endurance. And it's the willingness and ability to simply stick with something that you have wanted to do since you were 18 years old until you are in your 50s. Because he has wanted to work on the internet, on space technology, and on clean technology since he was like 17, 18 years old. And he just simply didn't waver from that ambition. Like, that was what he was going to do. And that's really amazing because I don't know many people that can stick with something for that long and endure as much as he's endured. But that's actually like the kind of thing that, and I don't think, by the way, I don't think it applies only for people who are young. I think it can apply for anybody. If you decide tomorrow that there's some thing that you must do in the world, if you just stick with it for 3 decades, you can actually make a dent, right? With Shannon, the thing that I learned in exploring Claude Shannon's life, and again, he's less familiar to your listeners. So let me give context, which is in addition to doing path-breaking academic work in electrical engineering and mathematics, Claude Shannon was also a juggler, a great stock picker. He built a flame-throwing trumpet. He built a rocket-powered Frisbee. He built the world's first chess-playing computer. He would write poetry for Scientific American. He just did everything. He was a little bit like Richard Feynman. And I think the value in a life like Claude Shannon's, the reason I called the book A Mind at Play is because Shannon was always playing with things. He had a workshop in his house, a two-story workshop in his house, and he would invent toys. He would invent gizmos. He would invent gadgets. He had a kind of playfulness about all of his work. And everything, and what was work was play, and what was play was work. That was what was remarkable, is that there was sort of, he was seriously unserious, right? The people in our lives who have that quality are children. That is like that is actually that's a quality you could emulate, which is to actually find ways to turn your work into play and turn your play into work. And Shannon did that again and again and again, and it yielded fascinating insights throughout. But to me, it also, one other thing about Shannon, this is another lesson from Shannon's life, but it's related to this play thing, which is he had a willingness to venture into new fields where he didn't know anything and just kind of just decide that he was going to do something, right? So at one point he decides that he's going to try to go beat the Vegas casinos by building robotic devices to measure blackjack, or no, to measure roulette. So he just does it, you know? And there's a kind of willingness to just throw yourself into something you don't know anything about and then try to learn something from it that I think is very playful. And I think it's really powerful for people, particularly as adults. I mean, I'm sure you experience this. You just get stuck. You know, you sort of get tunnel vision. It's not every day that you decide, you know, I'm going to learn how to cook sous vide, or I'm going to go like learn how to horseback ride. Right. Kids are far better at picking up new things, like, and they have far more of an embrace of just like whatever the new thing is. And that's, Shannon did that very, very well. And he did it in a way that didn't make him a dilettante. It actually approached it with the same scientific rigor that he brought to other things. But there was a side dish of play that was really a big part of it.
I mean, these are excellent ideas, but I noticed there are two ideas pulling people in different directions. One is about Elon Musk be obsessive, yep, of one thing. And in fact, you gave this excellent talk on how you learned obsession from Peter Thiel and Elon Musk. But there's also the other idea that be playful, be open to new things, try different things, things that you've never done before. Are they at odds? They're pulling people in different directions?
I think they are. I mean, I would say I think Shannon and, you know, just from a character perspective, like people like Shannon are different from people like Musk and Thiel. I think it probably depends on whether you feel like you are too scattered. And if you are, you probably need to like follow the Musk playbook a little bit. And if you feel like you need a little bit more variety in your life, you probably want to emulate Shannon a bit. I think it also depends on exactly what people want to accomplish in their lives. But I feel like there's seasons too. There's seasons of focus and seasons of variety. And so if you're in a season of variety, Shannon is a great guide, right? And if you're in a season of focus, I mean, there's very few people you could emulate that would probably be better than Musk, because you would just like march headlong and go get whatever it is you want to get done in the world. But you're right, they're in tension. There's no question that these two ideals are these two figures are in tension.
Yeah, it really comes down to self-knowledge, knowing what you want, what you're suited for. I think another revelation would be that there are different paths to success. There's one, or maybe there are multiple ones that would work for you. I'm not sure what's a fast way to find that out, like which one's the best suited for you.
But I also think, it's, you know, it's one of the things you commented on, and clearly you do a good job of it, which is if you read more about more lives, if you read more biographies and you read more narratives about how people live their life, both in your discipline and not, you start to notice the people who you feel like, okay, I'm a little bit like this person, you know, or I really don't like the way this person lives their life, right? When you can start to see those patterns, you can start to say to yourself, you know, this seems plausible to me, but I would not want to end up like this. And I'm sure, by the way, that a listener, that one of your listeners right now is saying, you know, I think the Shannon life is the life for me, and I would never want to do what Elon Musk does. And I'm sure there's another listener who's saying the exact opposite, who's saying, yep, Musk, that's my North Star. That's who I want to be, more like that person. And they're saying, Shannon, that sounds like somebody who has too much time on their hands, you know? And so I think you have to, what you're saying is very true, which is a big part of this is personal. It's about deciding what kind of person am I going to be in the world. A good way to figure that out is to read, whether it's books or articles or documentary, whatever you want to find, however you want to get the information, you can start to notice like, okay, this person seems a lot like me, and I should listen and pay attention to what they have and what they've done and how they've structured their time and their lives and their friends and everything else, because you can actually learn a great deal from that. You know, and by the way, when I was researching the PayPal book, I interviewed this person who was very early at X.com. And there's a scene in the book where he walks into Elon's bedroom in this townhouse that Elon owns. And he walks in the bedroom and the room is filled with biographies of business luminaries. And he remembered seeing, like, on the top of a big pile, like a book about Richard Branson. And this gentleman, his line, he said, you could tell Elon was preparing himself for, you know, the life he has now. And so it's not like something that, you know, you're reading about these figures. These figures, meaning people like Musk and people like Shannon, read about their heroes too, and like probably use that process to figure out, okay, I'm like more like this than I am like this, right? And then you can kind of steer in that general direction.
Which is why books like The Founders and other books like it are so valuable to especially young people. These are data points that you can draw lessons from. So we're coming to the end of the program, but before we finish, I'd like to ask some questions about your own work. In your writing career, you've gotten to know Robert Carroll, is that right?
No, I'm not gotten to know him. I just admire him from afar.
So what have you learned from him?
Oh, man. It's a good way to segue from the thing we were just talking about. Within my field, which is sort of the writing of biography and historical texts, there is nobody that's better at it than Robert Carroll. You can learn any number of lessons from his life and his work. One of them is you have to be willing to stick with things for a very long time. Each of Robert Carroll's books takes on average 10 years to finish. 10 years on a book. I mean, I spent 6 on PayPal and I thought I was going to go crazy. You know, I mean, I was like, really, I was driving people in my life crazy. Robert Carroll spends 10 years on each of his books. He interviews hundreds of people. And so for me, like seeing that was inspiring because I thought to myself, you know, okay, I can like do one more interview. I can do one more discussion. I can find another source. I can keep going. That's like it's like a big thing because at some point, you know, you're on interview 75. You don't know if the book is going to be any good. You're kind of like, what is this crazy idea? How am I ever going to make, you know, these people come to life? And what if I can't get to Elon? But, you know, you just sort of do the Robert Carroll thing of like, nope, just do another interview. He has this other maxim. This is a sort of second lesson, which is turn every page. So one of the things that he did is that he had like an editor, I guess, who told him that he had, when you're researching something, you just have to turn every page. It's a hard thing to do. But it's the reason that I went through thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of emails was because I had Robert Carroll's voice kind of in the back of my head saying, just turn every page. Like, you don't know what you're going to find. And the truth is, he was right. Because what would happen is maybe on page like 750 or 1500 or something, I would turn the page and I would find something that nobody had seen in 20 years. And then I could take it and I could like share it with readers. And so a good example of this, just to make it concrete for your listeners, 9/11, the terrorist attacks on 9/11 happened during the middle of the PayPal story. And there's an email, a company-wide email that's sent out by Peter to the full company, kind of explaining his thoughts on 9/11. This was buried in the middle of a bunch of newsletters and things. And I mean, I'm like tons of stuff. And I see this email and I'm like, this is amazing. This is the CEO of the company trying to put the tragedy into context for people. Is amazing. And so I took it and I put it in the book. So you can read the email in full in the book. And so that wouldn't have happened, I think, if I didn't have this commitment to just like, no, just turn every page, go through every piece of paper. It is actually very important. The last thing I would say is Robert Carroll's books are good, not because they are so detailed, but because they are easy to read. So they're very long. For your listeners, like some of these books are 1,000 pages long. But they are so easy to read. They're a pleasure to read because he works to make them readable. And so in the same way, I hope that when you read The Founders, it was actually fun to read. There was humor and there were moments that, you know, were well written and there were scenes that you could see come to life. I am a big believer that history should not be dry, that like these moments should be interesting to read. They should make people laugh. They should make people cry. And Robert Caro does that very, very well. Like, his books are incredibly well written. And it's not like he's sort of, you know, walking you through this history and just this fact. And then this happened and then this happened and this happened. No, it's like it feels like a novel. It feels like you're reading a novel. And I want my books to feel like a novel. I want people to feel like they're on an adventure. Right. Because books take time to read. So and there's so many other things that compete for our time. So from Robert Caro, I learned that lesson of no, it's like your job as the author to actually make this interesting. If the reader doesn't get through it, or if they're bored, that's on you. That's like, it's actually important that they get through it.
And I would say you succeeded in doing that. The Founders is not a short book. It's 500 pages, but it's a page turner.
Thank you.
So before we wrap up, do you have anything else you would like to add to our listeners?
The thing that comes to mind for me is just the value of biographies in general, right? We talked a little bit about it, but I would say that let's take my books off the table. I hope your listeners read my books and enjoy them. But I would say that ever since I was a kid, the genre I was most attracted to were biographies. And when I was much younger, I had this peculiar habit of like, I was like in my teens, and I would basically buy biographies and I would read up to the point that they were like 25 or 30 or something. And then I would stop and then I would like leave the book for later.
Hey, that's a good idea. That's I'd go back
and finish the rest of it. But I think that there's something about it. You really do learn. It's going to sound so obvious, but you really do learn a lot by just seeing how people make decisions about their lives at different crucible moments, at different forks in the road. How did somebody choose A over B? One of the best places to do that is through biographies. And you can often find a lot in there that has nothing to do with success. It may have to do with life challenges, right? So like here's a good example. You know, Teddy Roosevelt, like a famous American president, lots of books written about him. To me, some of the most interesting moments in the books about Teddy Roosevelt are in the aftermath of him, his wife and his mom die on, I think, the same day. It's one of the most unbelievable periods of his life. It's so tragic. And he goes into this kind of depression and he has to deal with that. And like just seeing like how somebody like that even processes grief, right? Because grief is going to come to us all, right? And so the idea isn't just that you're reading about Elon or Teddy Roosevelt or, you know, Harriet Tubman or somebody. You're not just reading about them because they can help you be successful, right? In any conventional sense. You're reading about them because there may be moments in their life when they face all the things that human beings are going to face that are just like you. And they had to get up and do those things too. And it is useful to see how they handled those moments. And that's what I think. I hope your readers embrace the part of biographies that is just about those little moments in the human experience that define everything. They're all there. They've been written about. And there's actually a lot of wisdom in those books. And so I hope that there's some portion of your readers who will embrace that.
Excellent. I certainly am a fan of biographies, and I wholeheartedly would encourage our readers to read more. So our guest today is award-winning author Jimmy Soni. His latest book is The Founders, 疯狂创新者. A lot of research has gone into this book and it really shows in its level of details. So our listeners, if you are interested in startups, innovation, and what happens when a group of exceptional individuals come together, definitely check out this book. Jimmy, thank you for the interview.
Thank you so much. This was a real pleasure. I enjoyed this conversation so much, and I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Look forward to your next book coming out and we can do another podcast.
That sounds great.
我的脚已不再重游，说一声你好，紧张不得了，你的脸上。